This is Susan B. Brock, Telluride Inside and Out. I'm speaking with Wade Davis, ethnographer, writer, photographer, filmmaker, licensed river guide, and explorer in residence at the National Geographic Society. Wade is a major supporter of mountain film in Telluride and a frequent guest. He returns this year to discuss two topics near and dear to his heart, the Stikine Valley in British Columbia, and a new book about Everest. Wade, thanks for joining me.
Hi, Susan.
Hi there. So, at Mountain Film Fundraiser back in December, you talked about the campaign to save the sacred headwaters of northern British Columbia, which is summed up, the story is summed up in your book, Sacred Headwaters. Please extrapolate from the example of place and talk about the ways in which the Stikine goes, so goes the world.
Well, you know, the Sacred Headwaters refers to this remarkable valley in northwestern British Columbia, whereby a kind of a wonder of geography, three of our most important salmon rivers, the Skeena, the Nass, and the Stikine, are all born within walking distance of each other. And it's always been sort of hallowed ground for all the First Nations of the Northwest Coast and the interior, but particularly for the Tahltan people whose territory it encompasses the area. And I think one of the things that's important for an American audience to appreciate is that in contrast to the United States, for example, where there's only one river that flows 1,000 kilometers without a dam, and that's the Yellowstone, and a river like the Columbia literally has hundreds of dams, and an iconic river such as the Colorado, its flow is controlled by technicians at 11 dams, and the river doesn't even reach the sea. It dries out before it reaches its delta. You know, Canada is still a place of wild and free-running rivers, and whereas, for example, the Grand Canyon of the Colorado has, 5 million visitors visit the park every year, and 27,000 people go down the river. Our biggest canyon in Canada, that of the Stikine River, which is known as the K2 of Whitewater Challenges, has had less than 50 people and all world-class athletes managed to get down it in all of history. And whereas, you know, Yosemite today is a park of relatively small size that is visited each year by a population equivalent to that of all of Los Angeles, you know, the Stikine remains an area, easily the size of Switzerland with less than 2,000 people. And the lower third of the Stikine River alone, just one section of one of these three magnificent free-flowing rivers, John Muir, who, of course, was the first to celebrate Yosemite, went up that river in 1879, and he called the Yosemite 150 miles long, and he never even saw the interior, let alone the sacred headwaters. And what's happening in this country, and again, you look at a map of the United States, and the farthest you can get away from a maintained road is 20 miles, whereas in the northwest quadrant of British Columbia, which is an area the size of the state of Oregon, there's really only one road. So this is really one of the last great pristine wilderness areas on the planet, let alone in North America. And because of the steroidal growth of the Asian economies, it's really unleashed a tsunami of industrialization in the entire sweep of that area. And much of the mineral exploration is occurring inside Tahltan territory. And so within a mere decade, literally dozens of very serious industrial initiatives have been proposed, everything from extraction of anthracite coal from the Sacred Headwater Valley itself, to Royal Dutch Shell and Shell Canada's proposal to put 6,500 coal bed methane extractive wellheads, literally linked by roads and linked by pipelines across like a sort of an industrial blanket over the entire extent of the Sacred Headwaters. And literally where I live on a lake called Yalui Lake, three miles from my dock, there's a proposal to place an open pit copper and gold mine that will process some 35,000 tons of rock a day for 30 years on a mountain that is home to the largest population of stone sheep in the world, and that if were to exist in any other corner of the planet would have long ago been cherished as a World Heritage Site or made into a national park. And so, you know, in a way, that particular mountain, Tottigan Mountain, has become a kind of a symbol because on the one hand, it's a sanctuary in the sky, one of the richest centers of wildlife concentration in North America, and yet here we are about to tear it apart to sell copper to Asian markets. And, you know, it's sort of like Glen Canyon. It's sort of the mountain that nobody knows. And one of the things that my book, The Sacred Headwaters, is attempting to do is place this extraordinary area before people in Canada and the United States, at least so that they can still have a chance to have their voices heard, so that all of this destruction does not simply go on in a void.
Okay. Thank you very much. Also at Mountain Film, you will be discussing your account of the British attempts to climb Everest. How would you characterize your unique spin on a subject that has been exhaustively covered in print and on celluloid?
Well, you know, it's a wonderful story. I was actually in Tibet, traveling 6,000 kilometers as part of an ecological survey in the summer when the dreadful events that John Krakauer chronicled so beautifully and in the thin air transpired on the mountain. And when I read the book, it struck me initially as sort of a fascinating story, but there was, as many people felt, there was something about the commercialization of the mountain that was disturbing. And then the next fall, by complete chance, I was back on Everest in the east face in the Gama Valley, attempting to photograph both clouded leopards and snow leopards. And we were stuck by unseasonable snowfall. And my colleague and friend I was with, Daniel Taylor, who had been raised in the Himalayas, son and grandson of medical missionaries, and indeed his father was a dear friend of Howard Somerville, who was Mallory's closest friend on Everest. Daniel suddenly started talking to me about these men who dressed in tweeds and read Shakespeare to each other in the snow, and I became completely enchanted. And a year or so before Conrad found Mallory's body, I took this idea to my publisher, to my agent, who took it to the marketplace to write a book about Mallory and those expeditions. And I was never interested in whether or not Mallory reached the top or not, per se. What interested me is why he kept walking to his death. And part of the idea I had, knowing that all of those men, the 26 men on the three expeditions in 21, 22, and 24, had likely gone through the crucible of the First World War, it struck me that perhaps for that generation that had seen so much of death, life mattered less than the moments of being alive. And that was sort of the idea that carried me forward. And then I sent a letter to my agent, and it resulted in the largest book advance in the history of any book on mountaineering. And I was sort of getting my research underway when Conrad made his stunning discovery of the actual body. And as you suggested, there were 8 or 10 books out by fall. And I actually went back to the publisher and I said, look, you know, the kind of book I want to write is going to take an enormous amount of research. I'll give you this money back because I can't compete with this kind of publishing schedule. And they very graciously said, we didn't give you that money for a book on Mallory. We gave it to you because we wanted a book by you on Mallory. And so I flippantly said it could take 10 years. And I'm afraid to say that it really did, because one of the things that those books did, they were in many ways a great gift to me because they forced me to take the story to a much deeper level. And so what I did over those 10 years of just extensive research was that I traced back through military and regimental archives the lives of each one of the 26 men to the extent to which I know where each one of them was literally every day of the First World War. And as I had anticipated, for not all of them, but certainly for 21 of the 26, they had in fact gone through the worst of the fighting. And so the book is really as much about the symbol that Everest became after the war and the kinds of lives lived by these extraordinary men who went through a kind of a passage that we in modern times cannot even imagine. I also, to tell the story from the Tibetan side, spent many months in the Himalaya, much of the time at the monastery of Thupten Choling, because Trusig Rinpoche, who is a lama of that monastery, which clings like a swallow's nest to the side of the Himalaya in Nepal, he was a spiritual son of Zatra Rinpoche, who was a Rinpoche that the British, of course, met at Rongbuk in 1921, actually in 22 and 24, because he was on retreat in 21. And so to go and live in that monastery was literally to know what it was like, in a sense, to be in Rombuk in 1921. And I also was able to get hold of a Namtar, the spiritual biography of the Lama, and have that translated fully for the first time. So it helped me tell the story as how the British were seen from the Tibetan side of things. But also, just in general, I was actually surprised how much new information there was to discover. Indeed, the book that's coming out in the fall, which is called Into the Silence, The Great War Mallory and the Conquest of Everest, is 700 pages long, and there is completely new information on every page. And amongst the most remarkable and fortunate discoveries I made was that one of the sort of unsung heroes of 1921, and in many ways 1921 was the most interesting expedition, because this, of course, was a reconnaissance when the British literally had to find the mountain. I mean, they'd seen it from a distance, but they had not literally gotten to its base. And the key to the mountain, of course, was the North Col. And Mallory is always credited with having found that route, but it was not Mallory who first identified it and charted it. It was an unsung hero, E.O. Wheeler, who was a surveyor seconded to the expedition from the Survey of India. And he was a Canadian who, in fact, with his unique photographic survey methodology, spent more time higher and closer to the mountain and alone on the mountain than anyone in 1921. I was fortunate to find his son alive, living by chance 5 doors from the house that I was born in Vancouver, of all things. And one of the accounts, or what from the 1921 expedition, of course, is that people refer to a diary of Mallory. Mallory never kept a diary. He simply wrote letters to his wife, and that's really what people refer to when they speak of Mallory's diary. And Guy Bullock, his climbing companion and former schoolboy friend from Winchester, did keep a diary, a rather short, curt diary that was published by the Alpine Club in London in the early 1960s. Howard Bury, of course, did his dispatches for the Times and so on. But at least as most historians maintain, there was no other journal kept. But in fact, as I discovered when I went to meet John Oliver, the son of Oliver Wheeler, his father kept a very dense journal, 2 full volumes, which had never been seen by any Everest historian. And in a very gracious gesture, John gave me these, or at least lent them to me, which I was able to use extensively in the writing of this book. And it's quite a remarkable story, because there was a lot of tension between Mallory and Wheeler, largely from Mallory, who, for reasons I still don't understand, had great disdain for Canadians. But in the end, they were the two men who, with Morshead, made their way with Bullock, rather, to the North Col in 21. And so there was kind of a sweet scene where Wheeler ends up having his feet rubbed with whale oil by Mallory after that near disastrous climb. So the book is really littered with new information, which is going to be very, I think, interesting for all those who love the saga of the mountain, and particularly for those who are intrigued by those early expeditions.
Okay, thank you very much. And just a coda on this discussion about Everest. Do you think that Everest is in some way Moby Dick, but in a different form? What makes the mountain so mythic? Why do men continue to hunt it, even to death?
Well, I think that what Everest has come to represent, or what it does represent, has very much shifted through time. I mean, I think today there's an element, at least, of being able to, I think it's very difficult for men in particular to find authenticity in their lives today. And I think climbing Everest is sort of a way that certain individuals can sort of feel perhaps alive for the first time in a long while. I think I'm not speaking about professional mountaineers as much as those who feel the urge to sort of climb Everest is almost like something, that they check off on a list of things to do in life. That's not to trivialize what the effort implies, but it seems to me that's part of what goes on today. But I think it was very different in 1921. In 1921, not only had the British lost the race for the poles, which was the initial kind of impetus to climb the so-called third pole, but after what these men had endured during the war, and indeed for the nation itself, Everest had sort of emerged as a sort of a symbol of reaffirmation that the old values were somehow still intact. You know, it's very difficult to, for those of us, particularly for Americans who were really untouched by the Great War, to understand what it meant to the British, not just the British Empire, but to the British people. The carnage was so extraordinary. There's a wonderful quote from Nancy Cooper that says, by the end of 1916, every boy I'd ever danced with was dead. And there was a sense after the war that the entire dance floor, if you continue that metaphor, had been removed mm-hmm. from beneath British society, and yet the people continued to pretend to dance in the air, you know. In 1920, more land exchanged hands in the British in Britain than at any time since the Norman Conquest, simply because of death duties and the exhaustion of capital. The British front was never longer than 125 miles. For much of the war, it was 85 miles. Behind that 85 miles of front line, the British built 6,000 miles of railroad, 6,000 miles of trenches. Places like the Ypres Salient, which saw massive violence throughout the entire war, a salient that you could almost walk around in a day. It was maybe 12 miles by 4 miles. Within that small area, over a million men died. You know, so the level of carnage, I mean, at the beginning of the war, for example, to get into the British army as a private, you had to be 5'8". That was in August of 1914. By November, the height limit had dropped to 5.3, simply because of the rate of attrition. You know, it's just beyond imaginings. I mean, to quote one interesting kind of anecdote that I discovered in my research, it's well known, for example, that Arthur Kellis, the high-altitude physiologist who, in fact, was too old for the war, died at Kampazong during the approach march to Everest in 1921. He had basically exhausted himself climbing, and he was way too old for the Everest game. He was 56 at the time. But at any rate, they buried him in a very picturesque place at Kampazong. And in Wheeler's journals, I was astonished to find on the day of the burial a curt passage that simply said, well, they buried the old boy in the morning. I thought it was going to be the afternoon. Terribly sorry to have missed the funeral, the event, but I do hate funerals. And this struck me so powerfully because, I mean, come on, there's six men walking together across Tibet. Can you imagine being on a expedition today and having one of your peers die and you're camped together and you somehow miss the burial? I mean, it's inconceivable. So obviously I knew something was going on. Well, once I got into the archival research and the regimental records, and one of the fascinating things about the Great War is that even though it was famously said after the Battle of Passchendaele and the Battle of the Somme that the army lacked the clerk power even to tabulate the dead, they nevertheless managed to write down just about everything else. I mean, the war was so thoroughly documented that you almost wonder how people had time to fight. And so if you do the research, you can find out almost anything about any point in the battlefield at any one point in time. And in the fall of 1914, the British regular army that had sent but four divisions to France in August was completely destroyed. And the British front was held by the Indian Army and by the Canadians. And Wheeler, of course, was attached to the Indian Army. And this was at a point in time where the topography of Armageddon had come into place. In other words, the trench lines had reached the sea. The architecture of the fronts had been established, and it had come to the attention of the British. And both sides were doing this, that the antagonists were sapping each other. In other words, they were building trenches at 90 degrees to the main trench line so that you could approach the enemy trench and throw bombs into it or raid the enemy trench. And it had come to the attention of Wheeler's battalion that the Germans had put two saps very close to their line, literally within 30 feet. And so the order went out that Wheeler and one other lieutenant were to take a group of 125 men on a raid. And he was, of course, a Royal Engineer, so their ultimate task was to bury the sap, but also to do so in a way that would dissuade the Germans from ever trying this again. They went over the top. All hell broke loose, machine guns, artillery. And as they got to the sap, they found to their horror that it was full of Germans about to attack them. And so the result was hand-to-hand combat of the most extraordinary, horrific sort. Eyes ripped out, ears bitten off, noses ripped apart. And in the end, the Indians managed to push back the Germans. But the entire sap, the entire trench, was lined body to body with dying boys, slain, as Wheeler said, like trout in my crail. He was from the Rocky Mountains and a great trout fisherman, fly fisherman. And literally, Wheeler did what he could to get his wounded out, but he never really knew if, as they shoveled in the dirt, they were not burying people alive. And so, you know, 4 years later, not 4 years later, I guess 7 years later, 1921, when he says at Campuzong, "But I do hate funerals," that's what he's talking about.
Thank you for that. Mountain Film's overall theme this year is awareness in action. It begins with their Moving Mountain Symposium and is threaded throughout the event. In that context, I refer you to the book by social philosopher, writer, and entrepreneur Paul Hawken. In his Blessed Unrest, and he spoke about that book in Mountain Film 2007, he talks about the growing unrest in the world, particularly in response to politicals, billionaires, and generals. But here's the good part. The purpose is not to grouse about the obvious. His emphasis is on the incredible number of people filled with love for their neighbor and for the earth who are taking action. Resisting, yes, and in a sense 9/11 was about that, but also restoring, renewing, and revitalizing, in Bill McKibben's words. Do you agree with Hawken that hope for the world is moving right now from the ground up?
Well, you know, I think, you know, I've always maintained that, you know, pessimism is an indulgence, and that, you know, people often ask, you know, are you optimistic? And, you know, as a father of children, I have to be optimistic in a sense. I mean, I do, and I also think that the way, you know, in a way history unfolds, and probably always has unfolded, is an ongoing ebb and flow and a push and pull between forces of light and forces of darkness. I mean, if I've sort of kept one thing from my Christian upbringing, it is a certain kind of sense that there is good and evil in the world. And you look around, and that's what you seem to see. So my sense is that I think that, you know, when we look back over the last 40 years and ask ourselves, is the world a better place than it was? I think it's a complicated answer. On the one hand, we can see the degradation of the world, the ongoing impact of industrialization, the ongoing kind of consequences of a particular worldview that sees the world as we do, as simply an inert body of mass ready to be exploited for economic gain, which is not, incidentally, the way that most peoples around the world view the earth. But on the other hand, we see, you know, women have gone from the kitchen to the boardroom, people of color from the woodshed to the White House, gay people from the closet to the altar. You know, 30 years ago, no one spoke of biodiversity or even was aware of the notion of the earth being an interconnected web of life. Now those are concepts and words that are shared by school children. So I think, you know, in a sense, great progress has been made, and that each of those little individual points of light that the first President Bush spoke of, and that in a way Paul speaks about in his book, I think that's all very true. But I think at the same time, I think we have to really work much harder at a progressive critique of the way we in the modern world, so-called, treat the planet. I mean, you know, one of the things that's so fascinating, and as an anthropologist, I'm often speaking about this, is that, you know, all cultures are myopic, fiercely loyal to their own interpretations of reality. So it's we in the so-called modern world tend to think of our way of life as not being a way of life as much as the inexorable wave of history, you know, that we don't think of modernity as simply a description, a word to describe a particular way of organizing, say, economic and political activity. We think of it as a sort of the irresistible wave of history, and it's not. And the way that we, for example, rationalize the industrialization of the wild is not is something very culturally specific. So, for example, think of what I'm going through with the Sacred Headwaters and my friends amongst the Tahltan. The thing that, you know, environmental considerations aside, what I find most interesting in looking at the sort of gold rush sweeping over northern British Columbia is that, you know, what does it take in our worldview, in our worldview of modernity, whatever you want to call it, to establish a mine, for example? Well, in Canada at least, all you have to do is cobble together a company that probably has less history than my dog, get online and secure the subsurface rights to a place you've never been, a land you do not know, the stories of which you've never heard, the pain of a long winter you've never experienced, nor the promise of a bright spring. And as long as you can guarantee the government a revenue flow, either in the form of taxation or royalties, you secure the right, by definition, whatever your position is on the environment, to transform that place irrevocably. And what I find fascinating is that there's not a single metric in the calculus that rationalizes the industrialization of the wild that places any value whatsoever on the land left alone, or, inversely, places any cost to the commons, the rest of us, on its destruction. You know, and we take that for a given because it's the way we rationalize the industrialization of the wild. But it's really kind of odd. Think about it. You know, you're Susan in your little house in Telluride, and you've got a rose garden, and you're selling roses. And I walk by, and I say, wow, I'll get some roses, and I buy all your roses. We have a transaction. You're happy, perhaps. You know, the roses have come out of the ground. I'm giving you the money. You seem happy. And as I walk away, I say, by the way, I'm destroying your house. Yeah, and you say, what? I thought we were talking about roses. Well, we're talking about roses, but incidentally, in getting these roses, of course, I'm destroying your house. Well, and then you say the obvious, well, what are you going to compensate me for that? Oh, no, there's no compensation. What are you talking about? I'm giving, you know, 3% of what I get from the roses I give the government, and I'm giving you a job right now because you're a rose seller. I'm, you know, a successful transaction, and your house has been destroyed. And, well, you know, that's how the native people look on this, right? I mean, a mine comes in and there's no compensation and there's just no value. It's as if the house, the valley itself, doesn't exist or something. And we take that as a given because, you know, we come from this world that has, you know, from the time at least of Descartes and long before that, when we reduced everything to mind and matter, as Saul Bellow said, science made a house cleaning of belief, and the idea that the earth could have anima was reduced as sort of ridiculous, ridiculed. But in fact, you know, most peoples around the world, it's not that they sort of think the earth necessarily is alive like some kind of creature. It's a much more subtle intuition. You know, they literally believe that the earth can only exist because it's filtered through the human imagination. And so, you know, we treat the earth as if it's simply an inert body of rock ready to be mined. Most people see some kind of metaphorical relationship to landscape that involves reciprocal exchanges between human beings and the landscape, such that the landscape gives bounty to the humans, but the humans in turn allow the landscape to exist. So that, you know, I was raised in Canada to believe those valleys are just rock, you know, piles of rock ready to be mined. Well, that makes me different from a kid in the Andes who's raised to believe that the mountain is an Apu spirit that will direct his destiny. Now it doesn't matter who's right and who's wrong. The important point for humanity is to observe the consequences of the belief systems and the relative ecological footprints that each belief system has on the land. And of course, we, you know, have ridden roughshod over the earth and drained the oceans, etc., because of a particular way of thinking about it. But that's not the way most people think about it. I mean, next week, for example, I'll be taking friends and a delegation of Kogi and Arawakos from the Sierra Nevada de Santa Marta to meet His Holiness, the 14th Dalai Lama, at a peace summit in Newark, New Jersey. And one of the things so fascinating about the elder brothers, as this complex of societies in the Sierra are known, is that they are still ruled by a ritual priesthood, and they speak in full sentences about the human obligation to change the way we interact with the natural world. They look at us as the younger brothers, and in complete bewilderment, they cannot understand how it is that we do what we do to the earth. So, you know, these other cultures actually are paying attention in a way that we're not. So if Paul's book is to have any meaning, we're going to have to, not his book have any meaning, but if his hope is to be realized, would be a better way of looking at it. You know, we need not just wonderful individuals doing wonderful things. We also need a profound shift in our entire mindset. And I think that can happen as a consequence of these wonderful things and these wonderful deeds, because it's all part of this slow transformation. But meanwhile, there are very, very strong forces, if you will, moving in the other direction, you know, huge economic pressures. When you think of the plans, for example, I mean, one of the things at the Sacred Headwaters, one of the great initiatives being proposed is the extraction of coal bed methane gas from underlying seams of coal. And this, of course, is a technology which is really beginning to sort of sweep the world. It's completely untested and untried, but it involves fracking the coal. So you literally, the methane gas in microscopic bubbles, in a sense, is held under pressure by underground water in these coal seams. And one of the things you need to do is you release the water, and each wellhead may produce as many sort of three Olympic swimming pools full of what can be very toxic water that has to be removed and disposed of. And then the gas, it can be liberated, but to facilitate its liberation, another technique is to frack the coal seam by injecting under high pressure thousands of gallons of toxic chemicals in a kind of soup that blasts open the coal and liberates some methane. And there's something of great concern, not only in the fact that this is a relatively untested methodology, and there's been lots of evidence that it causes problems to aquifers and wells in Alberta have blown up. People can at farms in Alberta can light their tap water on fire. The gas migrates, and that's a big concern. But metaphorically, it's even more grotesque. I mean, think about what this means: going to the headwaters of three of the most pristine salmon rivers on Earth, and literally injecting, like as if you've got a big hypodermic syringe, thousands of gallons of known toxins, I mean carcinogens, like benzene and radioactive compounds, and you're injecting them into the earth just to blast apart these coal seams to liberate methane gas. And if we decide to go that route, and if that is embraced as a legitimate way of extracting hydrocarbons, then watch out, because the entire eastern half of the United States, of course, is underlain with great fields of shale, all of which can be fracked. And so, you know, this is kind of an interesting point in time where, you know, the fracking process makes the traditional and conventional extraction of oil and natural gas seem utterly benign. And it's kind of a point in time where it seems to me that if we're prepared to embrace the fracking of coal seams and shale in this massive way, then God knows, I mean, there's just no limits to what we're prepared to do in our kind of gluttonous pursuit of energy sources from hydrocarbons.
Well, on that dark note, we'll end and remind everyone that Wade Davis will be coming to Mountain Film and Telluride over Memorial Weekend. He will be talking about more about what you've just heard, and especially what's germane to the themes of his two books, Into the Silence, The Great War, Mallory and the Conquest of Everest, due out this fall, as is Sacred Headwaters. Wade, thank you for your time and for your eloquence.
Thanks, Susan. Bye-bye.
Thank you.